kit. There's a question. Before I start this kit, which I was told is one of these, can you take some of the mysterious tricks of working on winding toroids? Is there some tricks that you know, that being that you fellas most likely have had experience in this field, Dick? And you want to say some words about winding toroids, over.
If the instructions are sufficiently complete, twisting a couple of enameled wires together, a green one and a red one, and winding them the right number of turns through a toroid, and taking the green lead and attaching it to pin number one and the red lead to pin number two on the input end and similarly on the output end, there's no real trick to that. There's no real magic to that. But assuming the instructions are properly written and a reasonable illustration of what you're working on and how it's going to look like when it's finished. And by the way, I've had a very pleasant experience in the last 2 weeks on toroid-like transformers. My client needed a one-to-one balance that was a current balance. We've needed that for some time. We wanted very high impedance current balance, but one-to-one impedance ratio. In other words, we had a grounded input coaxial cable on the input end of this balancing device, and the output end we wanted to be something like twin lead, 50-ohm twin lead, but we wanted that twin lead to be thoroughly floating with reference to ground. No significant common mode impedance, as it's called. And so I went to the mini circuits catalog, let me drop, and found this nice toroid transformer, four or five different models. I went and got some samples from mini circuits of those models. And the only reason, in my opinion, that someone would ever use a one-to-one impedance ratio RF transformer, this thing is very small, I think it's like 150 thou wide and high, square and wide and high, maybe 160 thou. The only reason you use a one-to-one transformer is because you want impedance isolation. Very similar to the way we use these ferrite balance made by Unideller, or wind up a couple of turns of coax cable at our Yagi antenna and tape it together, for that kind of a balancing function. The only reason anyone would use one-to-one is they want isolation. The data sheet tells you everything you want to know about input impedance, output impedance, insertion loss, return ratio, you know, voltage standing wave ratio, all this kind of data, physical sizes, soldering characteristics. The one thing they don't tell you is the amount of isolation it gives you. I find many of the brand names of isolation transformers don't tell you the amount of isolation. I had to go and measure it. In my particular application, I would have been happy to get 200 or 300 ohms of impedance to ground on the output end. And the answer turned out to be 1,450 ohms to ground. And reactive, slightly capacitive, even though it's an inductive device. A little bit of capacitance between the turns ratio. Very pleasantly surprised. Since that performance, by my standards, is so good, I'm still mystified why that parameter is not on the data sheet. The whole reason you buy it is for the isolation, and they don't tell you the amount of isolation you get. So a little bit of a mix-up occurred, but it's not only a function of mini circuits. Many of the manufacturers of balancing devices do not tell you the amount of isolation it gives you. So therefore, if you are modeling and studying schematically the circuit you're going to put it into, you'd like to know the amount of isolation. And that's not there. You got to go out and measure it. Thank goodness the first one I measured was a good one, because some of the others of the series were not so good. Had I measured one of those first, I would have given up on the project prematurely. K2KEY, K2RIW. Don't worry about winding
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Don't worry about winding toroids, is my impression. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. What a question is about some trick. Well, and winding toroids, basically, is a simple rule of thumb that I've used seems to be fairly successful. I allow 1 inch per turn. So in other words, if I'm going to make 8 turns, 10 turns, That's what I put with the 8 turns with the 8 inches of wire. You cut the piece of wire first, then so you don't have to work with a spool of wire, you know, feeling that you're going to run short. So allow 1 inch of wire per turn. Every time you go through the center of the toroid, you count that as a turn. In other words, you start out, you put the wire through, that's the first turn, so on and so forth. And I tell you, as far as like Dick said, working with the toroids, not really just a little, you know, practice and everything, but you'll find out that they're so wonderful because the advantage to a toroid over what we used to fool with IF scans and all those goodies is that they are self-shielding, so they can be mounted close to other components and they don't have to be, worry about adverse effects, to adjacent components. You agree, Dick? Over.
Oh, yeah. Compared to the normal EI-type transformers and others, a well-designed toroid transformer does have all of the magnetic field coupled within those wires, within the ferrite or whatever the actual iron-like material is in the toroid. It's a very high-efficient, compact transformer, and reasonably rugged. Does a darn good job. Just that you have to wind the wire through the transformer without taking the transformer apart most of the time. Most toroids do not come apart in pieces, whereas other kinds of old-fashioned transformers do come apart. So there's pluses and minuses on that, but since the performance of the toroid is so high, in most cases, you're willing to put up with the extra convenience of threading the wire turn by turn through the hole in the donut, so to speak, as opposed to winding it on a bobbin with a more conventional kind of transformer that's lower in performance. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, right, 100%. And I just say they look like they are a challenge, but I have wound quite a number of them. And most of the amateur radio projects you will see, they require either what was called a T50 or a T37 type cord. Most of this circuits are wired either with number 24, 26, 28, or number 30 wire. And believe it or not, slight variations in the wire. If, for instance, you went from a 24 to a 26 wire and made basically the same amount of turns, believe it or not, the toroids in many cases are very forgiving. It doesn't seem to, the toroids are like, you know, you can spread the wire out properly along the toroid. It seems like it's very forgiving because a number of times I did have the article may have specified like 28 wire, number 28 or something, and I had number 30 wire, and I wound it, and I didn't see any difference really in the performance pickover.
That makes a lot of sense. Where you go from one gauge to a finer gauge, maybe the current capacity is a little bit lower. But rarely do you use these transformers at anywhere near the maximum current rating of the wire. And the way wire works, when you're twisting two leads together to make a bifilar winding, the capacitance you get per inch on small diameter wire or large diameter wire, and the larger diameter wire has a little bit more thickness of the varnish coating, you end up with the amount of capacitive coupling between the wires very similar, even though you change the gauge. So, except for a little bit of difference in the resistance of the winding, or a little bit of difference in the maximum current capacity, it stands to reason that a change in wire size, within reason, is not a showstopper. Now back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I'm right. So the final words on it would be that go for it. Build a project with it and all. The only other thing I can think of off the top of my head is when you want to, the two finished wires or whatever comes out, scrape the enamel off the wire. Don't try to heat it off. A lot of people have tried to heat the enamel off, and you then, if you don't scrape it off, you know, use like a, an X-Acto knife, and then you can pin it better. Because if you don't clean it correctly, the ends of the wire, there was a lot of problems. I know people building kits found out the hard way that you will possibly have a cold solder connection. So by scraping the ends of the wire very clean and then pinning them, you'll get a very good positive connection to the circuit board. All right, a lot of people used to go about doing things like gluing the toroid down to the board to hold it in place. Not a recommended situation. Some of the equipment did come through that way commercially and all, and there were problems that pasting it down to the circuit board in later use, Dick, over.
WB2EAV.
Go ahead with your comments, Ed.
Yeah, the problem with the scrape, using an X-Acto knife to scrape the enamel insulation off magnet wire, some of the insulations supposedly do dissolve in heat. The problem is, it's meant to be used with high temperature solder pots. Then you dip it in, let the insulation melt, and then thins the wire. Most people do not have the proper setup to do that. I actually at work was working on these things, and in the end we just scraped the wires because getting the heat sensitive insulation properly was more trouble than it was worth. Dick?
Let me ask you this, Ed. At one time, the GC company, among others, made a fluid which, when you dip the end of a varnish piece of wire into it, it would melt the varnish, the coating, the insulated coating. And that would do a very neat job of cleaning off the end of the wire. Doing it with an X-Acto knife, if you're not skilled, does a mediocre job. You might not get a good solder joint. And when it comes to very fine wires, you got to be kind of careful you don't cut through and nick the wire and make it mechanically weak. But do you remember those fluids that would dissolve the varnish, the insulation on the end of the wire? So back to you, Ed.
No, I don't. But I will tell you, all the different sources of magnet wire these days have like a dozen different varnishes, enamels, what have you. And I suspect each one would need a different solvent. And yes, I did a lot of playing with an X-Acto knife with 36-gauge magnet wire. And let me tell you, you got to be careful.
You better be doing it under a microscope, otherwise you won't recognize the fact that you've almost cut through with a nick somewhere and created extreme mechanical weakness that could give you a failure downrange. When you're doing this kind of work, and if you're more than 22 years of age, unless you're very unusual, your eyesight is not quite that good anymore, and so a mechanical aid of a good stereo zoom microscope or a similar jeweler's loop-like thing will help an awful lot. Whenever I do work these days on surface mount and wiring and toroid winding and whatever, I always inspect everything under a microscope, and quite often I find potential failures that could have been giving me a brief downrange. Nowadays, everything we build is so microscopic. You've got to have magnification. Lots of people will say, gee, my eyes are too old, I can't do this work anymore. It's just a matter of having the right tools to do the work. As long as your hands are not, shaking so bad because you've got Parkinson's disease. And even then, there are people with Parkinson's disease that will brace their hand against the edge of the table so that the shaking of the hand doesn't affect what they're doing. Even then, they can adapt. But good visualization, bright enough lighting, and the right kind of magnification can really help, in my opinion. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Now, Roger, this is K2KEY. The solvent you're talking about was lacquer paint in it that they actually put in a little bottle. It was basically the lacquer, that paint that they use like on automobiles. That was the stuff they used to thin it out. And they took that off the market. I think maybe with the vapors, maybe with fire situations. I don't know, but they stopped that. that was the kind of effect. If you took a little bit of that and put it on a piece of absorbent cotton and just, you know, rubbed it, you know, just rubbed the end of the wire with it, just sort of pulled it through between your fingers and a piece of absorbent cotton with the lacquer in it, it usually did take that off. But like Ed just said, there's so many different, like, lacquers now and, you know, different coatings that maybe that certain ones, you know, need different thinners. So you have to let you know what really the thinners were mixed with, you know, what the lacquer was mixed with. I guess you wouldn't know what thinners to use. So if you lay the wire down, you know, or put it between your fingers and just gently, you know, work it with a very sharp knife, like an X-Acto knife there, just do a careful job. And then if you tin it up carefully, I think you shouldn't have any problems of doing toroid stick over.
Glenn recognized. Some of those substances used to buy were essentially paint remover. There are kinds of paint remover that will remove many kinds of enamel, lacquer, and whatever. I think some of them are now known to be carcinogenic chemicals, but the paint remover you used to be able to buy from the Red Devil Company, I suspect there's a good chance it will remove many of the kinds of enamel on wire when carefully done. Let's see how Glenn does it. You got it, Glenn.
I'm waiting for a beep. Do I have it yet? Or?
Even basically not waiting for the beep and just proceeding. Go ahead.
Okay. Actually, using magnetic wire and stripping is generally solder pot method is a good one. That works relatively well with what I would call the low temperature insulation. Most of the magnetic wire is graded in temperature range. Usually like your Class B magnetics and Class F are usually 130 degrees and lower in temperature, so they'll melt pretty quickly in a solder pot. Class H, which is your 200 degree C materials and above, which are for your high temperature transformers, those you might have a little bit of a problem with the solder pot or trying to melt with a really high powered soldering iron. X-Acto knife helps. They do have stripping tools that are rotary where you can actually slide the tip of the wire inside that can actually grind the material off the end. As far as chemicals go, virtually any automotive stripper will do it, but unfortunately on those real high temperature wires, it could take a while for the solvents to actually start really working away on some of those higher temperatures there. They can be pretty tough. Casey, too, do I see back on the stick?
Hey, you just gave us a fairly interesting piece of information I didn't know of. I didn't know there's various classes of enameled wire made for different temperature ranges. So from what I just heard from you, there are kinds of wire made for very high temperature service where the insulation will hang in there, and therefore you can really push the performance of the device and let it glow in the dark. Is that almost what you're saying there, Glenn?
Yeah, absolutely. Safety agencies, Underwriters Laboratories, or like Germany, now it's like they have CUL, which is the Canadian agency. Each one have a list of, and most of them now, the safety agencies have all kind of like unified into, you know, like one standard for magnetics. But part of safety agency approval, when you're running a device that's using an isolation transformer, aside from isolation and other standards, you limit the temperature. You have to operate the transformer in application at full load power. And there has to be thermocouples on the core, on the insulation between the wires themselves and the wire itself. And especially if you're going to be isolating from line voltage, you not only have to meet the insulation grade, so the materials have to characterize the temperature for both the wire insulation, the insulation material itself, and the bobbin. And also the materials of each one of those can't be chemically reactive. So normally each company that produces a transformer has a system, what they call an isolation system, of materials that are allowed to be used together that don't interreact. And temperature, of course, depends on the rating. Like I said, Class B is a lower temperature, Class F is a little bit higher, Class H is the king of the road, and you're up there, like, you know, 200 degrees C transformer.
Very nice. So Class F, I think it is, or H. I think you said 200 degrees C, which is twice the boiling temperature of water in degrees C.
200 degrees C, I guess is 470 degrees Kelvin, really getting up there, and relatively high reliability. Who is setting these standards? I presume these are for consumer products, for consumer safety. Is it Underwriter Laboratories, or are these MIL specifications that you're working with that's setting the standards that you're describing, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, in today's day and age, originally most of them started off with, there's a couple of companies out there, of course, Underwriters being one of the major ones, they're independent labs. Then there was, of course, Factory Mutual, which was an industrial company that basically insured large industrial sites. So if you have the Factory Mutual, make sure you have safe devices that don't burn down buildings. Underwriters in Europe, you had the safety agency there. Similar to UL in Canada. And normally, if you look on the back of most of your consumer products, you see these markings that will, you know, rate their level of approvals. And there'll usually be a mark on the back and also like a serial number that shows, you know, to what level it's been tested to. So there's actually, every time a product is approved to one of these, there's a file in UL or whatever safety agency has the marking for that's on it. Now, the military, interestingly enough, is adopting a lot of the IEC, World Safety Agency, types of standards, and they're following them now. So the differential, like when you see something like 1940 or any of those other standards, it's kind of like everybody's kind of like unified and following them now. It's like international standards. Back over to you, Dick.
Interesting. Is there a MIL-E 5400-like MIL-SPEC that the covers these kind of, that's normally an electromagnetic interference spec. So I guess there must be a military standard spec that you probably know the number of that addresses this subject. Is that true, Glenn?
Yeah, actually, Dick, if you look at anything like some derivative of the number of like 1940, 6940, 22094, you'll find whether it's IEC, UL, usually something with 940 inside that is usually an indicator that that's the electrical safety agency specification. But I could look into that. I don't know the number off the top of my head for the MIL one, but I can look them up for you if you're interested.
It's good to
put MIL standard 461 for EMI testing, or do I misunderstand?
Well, it's not so much electromagnetic interference we're talking about here. We're just talking about human safety and the temperature ratings and voltage ratings of things to make sure that the consumer, when he uses it, doesn't get shocked, I guess is the main thing, and doesn't burn down the building. So fire hazard, voltage safety hazard, these are the things that I think we're addressing here. Is that true, Glenn?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certain numbers that like come off the top of my head. These aren't the number of standards that like typically today, if you have a product, whether it's being introduced anywhere in the world, and military products are even, because they have to be used in certain installations that are public installations, so they all kind of meet a lot of these standards now. Like, typically if you have a high pot like 2120 from input terminals to chassis, same thing with output to chassis, and you have that like 4240 volts DC from input to output. You know, there's a lot of these kinds of standards, and of course the temperature ratings on materials and the reactivity of the materials are also important. But yeah, no, there's specifically safety agency approval type of documents. And I've seen them also now winding up in many military, especially land-based and, not necessarily in your aircraft and seaborne and stuff, but you might see it in with the base operations type of thing. And even in some of the mobile equipment as well.
Good to know. Mr. Gellin, do you want to add anything to this? KQRIW?
Nothing at the moment.
Okay. Sounds like you're out doing your walk tonight, and you got some pretty nice weather out there. Mel, KQKEY, KQRIW.
Okay, very interesting. This is KQKEY. Something, as they say, every day. And yes, I understand there's a lot of work to wire and things, and we just, off the top of your head, not to think twice about, but surely you've taken into consideration quite a number of products today. I could say military specs and all. Sorry, I'm just looking for some. Oh, here's a good one. I'm interested in doing some satellite work. Say some words about circular polarization. Let's see. There's an antenna that is in the handbook called a ring sub-circularly polarized antenna. Do you know anything? Is this a good satellite antenna for working satellites? You ever hear of it? The ring sub-circularly polarized antenna, Dick. I bet you're familiar. Over.
I wish I could say I was. I'm not. For those who want to review the show that we had last week, under www.amateurradio.tv, and you can listen to what Mel and Dick and all the other guys signing in had to say last week. And that beautiful website by Mr. Perry in New Jersey records all of our great words. Mike Perry, KC2NJI, Kilo Charlie 2, number November Juliet, India. I hear tell that for those who are sufficiently skilled with computers, and maybe it's on the LIMARC.org website, there's a way of listening to the TechNet live by listening to a particular website. But what I'm saying, though, is that last week, Mel and I did discuss quite a bit of circular. I'll give you a couple of words on it now. If you set up a linear polarized antenna to listen to a satellite, and if the satellite is known to be transmitting circular polarization, you're losing 3 dB of the signal. That'll affect your signal-to-noise ratio. And in some cases, you will experience some QSB fade as the satellite rotates, as it tumbles in space. In most cases, they are intentionally turning as a method of getting gyroscopic-like stabilization. Setting up a homebrew or commercially made antenna for circular polarization is not difficult, but a lot of people are intimidated by circular polarization. Unfortunately, even among antenna engineers, circular polarization and all of its nuances are quite often not well understood. Mel and I last week were talking about how to make a circular pattern on an oscilloscope screen by putting the exact same sine wave into the vertical plate, the exact same sine wave into the horizontal plate, but having one lead in phase by 90 degrees compared to the other. Well, the word phase shift on electronic signals, sine wave signals, also intimidates people quite a bit. So we got a little bit of a problem there of definition. But the circular polarization and an antenna that has that property, not very much more difficult to construct, not very much more expensive to buy. The number of antennas you can buy that are circular polarized, I'll admit, is drastically smaller than the linear polarized ones. But if you get the right kind of AMSAT literature, Amateur Satellite Corporation, they've got lots and lots of suggestions. If you Google the word AMSAT and circular polarized, an antenna and circular polarized, guaranteed you'll get 10,000 hits. So there's lots of articles on the subject. Some of them are construction articles. So digging in and finding out how, finding it in the right book, not too difficult. And read enough of those articles and you'll eventually understand it. It will be a little bit intimidating at first. Maybe that's not quite the answer he's looking for, but at least that's the beginning of an answer. K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, well, let me just say that. But if you look at an antenna from, or I should say a satellite operating at amateur radio two meters, and without circular polarization, basically, Dick was saying it, if the satellite was spinning, it would be actually spinning like 140, equivalent to 146 million times a second. So You know, so by using a fixed sensor, as we discussed, the spring, sort of the spring sub-polarized antenna, I think I saw it in a handbook, it's made out of copper pipe. You bend the copper pipe into like a circle, then bend the one end up and the other end down. And it's, in fact, it's that antenna, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't that the antenna that was featured one time? I think your friend Kent. Sure, I think Kent, what's it, WA5, BJ. I should know Kent's call, WA5CJD. I think, isn't that the antenna he featured, Victor, once over?
Yeah, Kent has some circular polarized antennas. He also has some ring printed circuit-like antennas, which are believed to be circular polarized, and there's a little bit of doubt on that. There are a couple of antennas out there in the world where the author of the antenna, the creator of the antenna, has created a somewhat simplified printed circuit structure antenna, which he believes is circular polarized. A few of them are not. So you got a little bit careful here. There's a little bit of misconception going on how to properly generate circular polarization. In general, a circular polarized antenna, like a turnstile or like a cross-polarized Yagi structure, has what purely looks like a horizontal antenna combined with a co-located or nearly co-located vertically polarized antenna. And if you feed equal power to the horizontal and vertical portion of the antenna and create 90 degrees of phase shift, which in some cases can be done very simply by a quarter wavelength of extra cable, electronically quarter wavelength of extra cable, and all of a sudden this somewhat simple structure generates beautiful circular polarization. So generating CP, once you understand the concept, is not too difficult. Doing it with gain is not too difficult. Some people like doing it with a helical-like antenna, and that's a little more troublesome because a fair number of the helical designs are kind of marginal designs, not because of the concept, but because of the embodiment, the way it was actually carried out. There's a number of ways you can go wrong in building a helical antenna. Just you substituting, let me drop, substituting a different dielectric constant of the support material that's supporting the individual turns of a helical antenna can significantly change its design. So a number of people have fallen into that trap. I have personally made a circular polarized antenna with high gain by taking two Yagis, one horizontal, one vertical, mounted them so that the booms are touching each other with hose clamps around them, holding them together, with one antenna a couple of inches ahead of the other mechanically, just so that the elements are, the horizontal and vertical elements are not touching each other, and then choosing the appropriate length of the feed lines going through them from the power divider to make a beautiful circular polarized antenna. As I said, you investigate the literature from AMSAT. Katani knows, I can't remember his call letters, had a number of antenna designs that various AMSAT user people have duplicated those designs rather successfully. But there is a lot worth pursuing on CP antennas if you're doing Oscar-type satellite work. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, well, sounds like circular polarization is the way to go. Okay, very good. So, here's one. Oh, boy. I know you're not going to read this, Mel, because I don't think you believe in this, but I dare you to put it out on the tech test. All right, let me tell you what this is all about. There's a group on 75 meters, and they are the DX group. There's a group of guys at this net. That's what they do. They work a DX station, one at a time, and, you know, each one give a signal report to the DX station. And now the DX stations are doing the same thing. There's one, like a group of guys in England or something, or Europe, and they're doing that too. They take turns giving each other signal reports. And you don't believe that the best DX on 80 meters is when there is a full moon. That's the night we pick for our DX netting. Why don't you believe that the full moon makes better DX now on 80 meters? I could say, Dick. I'm doubtful on this one, over.
Yeah, so am I. I won't say it's impossible. 80 meter DX is highly dependent on the status of the ionosphere. Because on 80 meters, if there was no ionosphere, you'd have an awful lot of trouble getting beyond 50 miles of range. And most of the people you talk to on 80 meters are going to be well beyond 50 miles. So, is the ionosphere giving you the proper reflection? Is your antenna launching a signal at a low enough elevation angle? Is the state of Faraday rotation correct? Is the amount of noise on the band from lightning storms and whatever, the precipitation static, above some particular level? Is your local power company, LIPA and Con Ed and whatever, New Jersey Power and Light, is the local transformer making a whole lot of noise? There's a lot of variables involved in working DX on 80 meters. Let me drop. And of all the things that can affect the ionosphere, the solar wind, aurora borealis, solar ejection phenomena. In other words, I can't think of the name of a three-letter abbreviation, but every so often the sun, you know, sends out a tremendous amount of material at literally a million miles an hour, and those charged particles hit the upper atmosphere, and they definitely affect the ionosphere. The sunspot cycle has a lot of effect. Is the moon a major determining factor in the state of the ionosphere? I think it's a minor factor, if it's a factor at all. The moon is a quarter of a million miles away. The ionosphere is only a couple of miles away from you. So, boy, that sounds like a law of diminishing returns, if ever. I mean, if you go deep enough in your statistics, I could prove to you that the signs of the zodiac are having an effect on the ionosphere. But that's a tough one. So, I'd like to know what evidence the person has, and I'd like that evidence to be more than anecdotal. To have a group of guys who start off with the belief and confirm it by their particular methodization, that's not exactly traceable to the Bureau, and will it survive peer review? If by some means you do a double blind test and really find out if the phase of the moon affects DX in certain directions, now that would be a real interesting project. It could even be a doctoral thesis to support or deny the hypothesis. But, I mean, other than anecdotal evidence, I'd like to know what real evidence they have that, as we say, is traceable to the Bureau. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Now, I said that's what I asked. I said, what are you based upon? They said, well, the moon is reflecting back the sun, and the sun actually is ionizes the F layers. So we have found that when they have tracked on, especially on the calendar and all, the night of the full moon, they have over a period of now, they came up with this, they said over a period of the last couple of years, have noticed the signal strength on the DX station and the available of the DX station is greater when the moon is full. I couldn't really, you know, present much more of an argument other than saying what you base it on, and it seems to be on the reflection, moon being reflecting back the sun, over.
Boy, that's a long shot. Those particles of the solar mass ejection come flying out from the sun, highly charged particles, roughly a million miles an hour, tremendous numbers of them, millions of pounds of the stuff, come flying past the Earth. A small percentage of them hit the moon. The ones that hit the moon are going to sit, are going to hit that regolith material and stick. Are those particles going to strike the lunar surface, bounce off, and come back to the Earth? Wow, that's a long shot. Are they going to be affected by the moon's magnetic field? Well, the moon almost has zero magnetic field. I mean, the particles that come from the sun are highly influenced by the Earth's magnetic field. They get trapped by that magnetic field, and they only come down the two places where the magnetic field dips into the Earth itself, at the North Pole and the South Pole. That gives us the Aurora Borealis and the Aurora Australis. So the magnetic field of the Earth certainly affects these charged particles coming from the sun. But the moon being really a non-reflector of metallic particles and being not electrostatically charged per se and have very little magnetic field, by what means does the moon reflect or somehow deflect or refract or however change the guidance of these particles and bring them back to Earth? On top of that, the total swept area of the moon, a quarter of a million miles away, compared to the Earth, boy, it doesn't have very much resources to do it, and it's very far away. So you can see why I'm skeptical. I'm not saying impossible, but I want to hear a little bit more about what do they believe is the mechanism of this phenomenon, and just saying it's a reflection doesn't sound like enough to give me a warm feeling. K2KEY, K2LIW.
K2QIQ in comments.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I heard this claim made about 20-some-odd years ago, and I think you may be looking at it from the wrong end. It may not be the propagation end that's affecting it, but the way it was put to me was that during full moon cycle, the ground, the water content or the ground resistivity becomes lower. Because then again, you know, this is what I've heard. I've never tested it, don't really know anything about it, but I heard this actually has to do more with ground conductivity and higher water tables and higher water levels, but actually the propagation will improve because of better ground performance. But there again, just hearsay,
Okay, now, the moon just definitely affects the tide. So at a full moon, the tide is in a particular position when the full moon is at high noon to you, so to speak, at your meridian. The full moon at midnight gives you a very specific orientation, which forces the tide to be in a particular position. But now, is there very much change in 80-meter propagation as a function of tide? That's a tough one. If I lived right at the seashore and my ground plane antenna had its radios in the seawater, without a doubt I'm going to get a change. But that's not what I don't think we're talking about. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. I live quite a few miles inland from the sea. My 80-meter dipole is some number of feet above the ground in my backyard. And the tide that many miles away from me, is it really going to affect my 80-meter propagation? Boy, that's going to be a third-order effect, I think, from what I know so far. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Dang, this is K2KEY. Well, why said you want to put up an 80-meter antenna and get on 75 meters, you have a jolly old time. You'd be up till wee hours in the morning with these guys because you should hear some of this stuff. And some of them are backing it up. They are emphatic about these things. As I mentioned about the discussion a few weeks ago about hearing those echoes coming back hours and days later on a 75 meters, those stations that supposedly did it under very scientific analysis and said that the reflections of the signals coming back from on 80 meters, day later to 36 hours later? I mean, hard to swallow. In fact, did you know, Dick, they believe that if ever that the reason that we haven't made contact with some extraterrestrial, because we're looking in the wrong place. It is going to be someday on 80 meters, on 75 meters, Dick, over.
Oh, there are some strange extraterrestrial-like people on 80 meters. There are some people out of this world on 80 meters, as well as 432. Oh, boy. As I see it, read a book called 200 Meters and Down, which talks about the early days of radio and ham radio in particular. Go to UHF and SHF conferences like Microwave Update and the Mount Airy VHF Society meetings and the East Coast VHF Society conferences. You can easily come to the conclusion that the state of the art, the leading edge of ham radio experimentation, moves up in frequency roughly 10 to 1 every decade. When I got seriously involved in VHF in the late 50s, early 60s, 432 megacycles was a real frontier to get up that high in frequency. Why? You went way beyond getting a nosebleed to get up that high in frequency. Nowadays, guys are talking about 241 gigahertz two-way communication. So you go 10 years downrange, and the really progressive hams are using a frequency 10 times higher. And what used to be considered the useless frequencies are turning out to be very useful. We keep repeating that story every decade, ever since 1910. Every decade, we go 10 times higher in frequency. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. And whoever is talking about frequencies then will say, yeah, this band we found out is okay, but the next one higher up is going to be useless. Those words keep getting said over and over again. So there's strong evidence that real progressive research in radio propagation could be used. You could come up with a slogan. No frequency is high enough, as long as you've got the technology to really use that frequency. The higher you go, the more benefit you get. Just compare cable television to fiber optic-like cable. Wow, what a comparison. In insertion loss, bandwidth, number of services that can be carried simultaneously, the higher the frequency, the better. So, to think that really progressive societies, far advanced societies, favor 80 meters where it's very hard to focus that signal compared to some much higher microwave frequency where focusing becomes easier, that philosophy sounds to me hard to support. But that's one man's opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That is K2KEY. Well... I guess we'll never really know until it takes place, but that would be that a ham radio operator on 80 meters eventually and someday if happens to make that that contact would be an awful upset of a lot of people's ideas, but there have been a lot of upsets in the past, so I don't take anything off the table to Dick and say, you know, this is impossible. I have an open mind, and I can say, if you get on 75 meters, some of them are really something. You hear some, just listen to some of the QSOs, you would really flip out, because I'm going about, you know, talking about things that are mild. Some of the things I heard about a week or two ago were, if you want to talk about it, I would flabbergasted. I never hear that on ham radio, but I guess the sky's the limit, you know, whatever possibly could be put on the air. I guess somebody can take a shot at it and say things, and, when they're very serious about things, I mean, they're serious. I can say I was privy to something last week that really shocked me. Okay, well, we're getting running out of time, so I don't think we're going to be able to pick up much more now, because we'll wind up right in the middle of some discussion. So I'm going to turn it back to you, see what else you may have tonight, Dick. This is KQKY.
I think I've run out of subjects for the time being. You guys have just wasted another few hours of your life, as they say on Car Talk, listening to TechNet number 1212 of the series that began in September of 1982. And as long as Mel and I stay healthy and the repeater stays operational, we intend to be back for 1213 next week and discuss more of this wireless jazz. There's a little more to the story. We haven't heard the end of it yet. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And back to you, Mel.
Okay. This is KQKY again. Thank you for all those interesting emails. And I've gotten a lot of them. And I can't sit down and answer every one of them, really, individually. I am just trying to bring out the interesting ones. And oh, I want to thank you all those for the positive feedback that we're getting. And I know there's a number of questions and all that, again, that we can't answer because a little too much for, I think, the tech test. Some are a little bit too highly technical, maybe, or, a borderline on not actually amateur radio, but more a lot on commercial electronic applications and things like that. So please try to refrain from that, but try to keep, in other words, in the realm of amateur radio, things that we can discuss, and not turn people off because it gets too in-depth. We do, even though we do get in-depth, as you see tonight, with a few things like tactile antennas and things like that, but we try to simplify it. So, with that, I'll say goodnight to all, 73, have a great week, and as Dick said, we'll try to do it again next week.
And by the way, to repeat again, Mel and I are, the main thing we have volunteered to do is to give the best answers we can of the group that has gathered live, verbally. We have never really promised that you're going to get a free written consulting service. We've never promised that. And if you think so, you're misguided, and you're going to be disappointed. Certain general class questions that are common to a whole lot of people that appear in those emails, Mel selects those, and we bring them on the TechNet and discuss them. A lot of people can benefit from it. You send us the manuscript to your book that you want reviewed. You send us the first draft of your doctoral thesis that you want reviewed. You ask us to do free consulting for some particular business you're running. This is way out of the realm of what we promised. We've only promised live question and answer among the gathering of the group, of the gathering of the clan. That's all we've really promised. Mel has sort of volunteered to try to help other people who haven't yet got their license, can't sign in, and we try to give them help in writing. But it's not promised that you're going to get an answer. Know when you write something to us, the chances of you getting a written answer are slim. Know that ahead of time. That's the risk you're taking. Okay. I think that bears repeating once in a while. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, Roger. Now, that's basically the bottom line. I guess some that are very hard to, turn them down, but like you say, you got to draw a line someplace. I have to use, as I said, a very sharp filter, very high Q filter here to, separate the ones off that I think we could easily put on a tech net here without too much problem. You got to, like I say, understand that Dick says this is all stuff that is, as I just read it, is off the top of our heads. Maybe we're not giving you even the right information. You know, somebody else may say, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. That's possible. You know, so understand that the price, as Dick said, the price is right, and we do our best. Okay, but that's 73 ball, and take care. This is K2KEY.
And by the way, our live material where we're giving you our opinions, and we try our best to make it accurate, it does have a kind of peer review. There are smart people in three nearly metropolitan states listening to this jazz. There are various people going to the website playing it back. There are various people calling me on the phone saying, I disagree with you here. Are you sure? In other words, we are getting a kind of peer review. So many of our errors are being corrected, it says here. Bye-bye, you all. See you down the line.
Exactly. Okay, 73, and true, I do get that also. And your number of them, I just can't go back and forth, you know, arguing the point. We do our best. Take care. We'll see you next week.